Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's program.
You see them walk over to the allotment gardens with their neighbors, sometimes with wine glass in hand, and they're showing off their little crops that they've grown in these allotment gardens, and they're socializing around this whole concept of growing food right at their doorstep.
Where is your nearest farm? For urban dwellers, agriculture can often feel like a world away from the city. This week, we're beaming in from Milan's Salone del Mobile, and we ask if a better connection with food production could make for a healthier and happier group of citizens and ensure a sustainable future for our cities too. On the show ahead, we assess the merits of an agri-hood sprouting up south of Vancouver, get the buzz on urban apiculture in London, and unfurl a toolkit for urban gardening developed in Milan. That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, before I introduce the first report today, you may hear the odd tooting of a car horn, the odd whizzing of a scooter, because we're recording right in the heart of Milan, in Brera, in our pop-up studio here for Salone del Mobile. So bear with us every now and then. But anyway, one of the results of recent world events and one of the topics that we've increasingly visited here on The Urbanist over the past 18 months has been city dwellers' connection to the food that they eat. Supply lines have been increasingly strained and access to good, healthy produce hasn't always been as simple as it once was. This realisation has prompted some of us, from mom-and-pop shops to planners, to foster a better relationship between us and our food, and shorten the distance between farm and table. To do so, an emphasis on urban agriculture and cultivating fresh produce within the city or your property boundaries has been sprouting up all over the world. I was joined recently by Bob Ransford, Vice President of Development at the Century Group, who are the development company behind Southlands, a new urban agriculture project, or AgriHood, taking form in the beachside suburbs south of Vancouver. Southlands is a master-planned beach community rooted in food production that aims to integrate farming and urbanism by design. I started by asking Bob to describe the Southlands project and what makes this development really so special.
Southlands is a community based on farming and food, and it's really the reintegration of agriculture at the urban metropolitan edge. You know, it's in metropolitan Vancouver, about 45 minutes from downtown Vancouver, in a typical suburban community. And its whole purpose is to, you know, reintroduce the culture of agriculture to a new sense of place at the edge of the region. And typically in metropolitan regions, we find some of the worst forms of urbanism. As you know, it's the least dense. It tends to have very few mix of uses. It's, you know, typical single family sprawling suburban growth, large single family lots, very auto dependent, very little commercial services within walking distance of the people who live there. And then you also experience at that edge probably some of the most unproductive use of fertile land, typically because that land is usually being speculated on that some type of urban containment boundary or growth limit will fall to some political decision and that will be the next land to be developed. So the owners usually give very little short-term tenure to farmers, and you find, you know, typical industrial type farming that's taking place there that, you know, appeals to the commodity markets of large crops. And, you know, that type of farming isn't even compatible with the people that enjoy that pastoral view over the farmland, but they're certainly not happy with the type of industrial scale agriculture that takes place across the other side of their back fence. So what we've tried to do is we've tried to reintegrate the farming that takes place at the edge of a city or town and has from, you know, the first places that mankind settled. They settled there because they could grow food. And typically our towns and cities grew up around farms, and you could buy farm products within the city from the area right at the outskirts of the city. And we've tried to reintroduce that whole concept, bringing a more local human scale agriculture to that land, bringing people to the urban edge in a more compact form of a community, more mixed use, more diversity of housing typology, and then integrating it socially, recreationally, economically, especially, you know, holding farmers markets right on the farmstead and having the people that live right there being able to buy fresh produce that's grown right there. That's really what Sothins is all about. And it's about replacing, you know, what we normally have is arbitrary regulation-based urban containment boundaries. And it's reintegrating that edge with food production. And you don't need an urban containment boundary then, because the people living there in a really well-planned community really value that agriculture continuing. And so that urban encroachment isn't going to happen in the future.
Beyond that, this issue of the food, which is something that intrigued us. So tell us, do you imagine that the people who live there will have a healthier lifestyle because they will appreciate the food being produced on their doorstep? Do you hope that they all become producers of food themselves? Because I know that there's going to be a setup for allotments, for example. How do you see that food relationship playing out in a more interesting way?
It's playing out as we speak, because we've built there about 75 homes, and so far over 60 of them are occupied. And in our civic square that we've developed, which is right at the edge of the farm, in fact, there's a road that comes in off the farm that the tractors can pull a cart right into the center of the civic square. In that civic square, we developed some allotment gardens there. We originally built 25 of them last winter. And as we started to approach this spring, I said to the fellow that runs it for me, you know, I think we're going to need more than 25 of those allotment gardens, because I think everyone that moves in is going to want one. He said, oh, I doubt that that many people will want to farm. Well, the moment we made them available, we ended up having to actually double the number of, more than double. We ended up building 55 allotment gardens. And I can tell you that if you go there at the end of a workday in the evening when people are coming home to their neighborhood, you see them walk over to the allotment gardens with their neighbors, sometimes with wine glass in hand, and they're showing off their little crops that they've grown in these allotment gardens, and they're socializing around this whole concept of growing food right at their doorstep.
Tell me, the kinds of people that you think will be tempted to move to your development, do you think there's going to be something unique about the kinds of people that will move here?
You know, if I look at the mix of people that are there today, it's quite a broad range of people motivated by a whole bunch of reasons to move there. I think some of them are values-driven people that, you know, with the pandemic, certainly we've seen people think more about the human connection to nature and how to restore that connection. And I think that's attracted some people there to escape the downtowns. You know, there's one young couple, for instance, I was walking down the street a couple of weeks ago, early morning, and their young toddler was out on the sidewalk in his diaper, and they were on their porch. And I laughed and said, he looks pretty comfortable here walking around nearly nude in the neighborhood. And they said, you know, this is such a special place for us, where we feel that our young son can walk down the road and look out over the farm fields, and we can take him and show him what's being grown there. And they had been living in what we call Yale Town in Vancouver, one of the most dense urban neighborhoods in the central business district of Vancouver. And they decided, now that they had a young child, that it was time to move out to a place where he could have a different experience.
And tell me, when you go to city authorities with a plan like this, I understand this piece of land has been a little bit contentious. You know, what should be built there? What should rise on the land? Are cities more willing to listen to you if you have a project like this, especially, I guess, in the wake of the pandemic, when we're all thinking about food production, our access to food, a greener, more sustainable way of living?
I think they are going to be listening to that. We have to get beyond some of the typical attitudes, which are that we draw hard and fast lines between urbanism and agriculture. Often we even require buffers between farmland and residential development. In British Columbia, where we've done this development in Metro Vancouver, we have something called an agricultural land reserve, and that's an urban containment boundary codified in legislation. And it requires a 100-meter setback between the farming activity and the residential development. And there's no way of blending it. And when you talk to them about trying to remove those arbitrary lines on paper and start to plan things and integrate things more intricately, their first suspicion is that you're trying to develop farmland. And so you need to get past that and explain what you're actually trying to do is reintegrate farmland with community living.
For you and your company as well, are you looking at additional sites where you can deliver this kind of solution for cities?
Absolutely. And not only that, but our mission statement as a development company is about connecting people through growing food as one of our missions, you know, also connecting people through transit. We have a range of development. For instance, we're doing now a 4-tower 1 million square foot development across the street from a major transit station in the suburbs of Metro Vancouver. And in that four tower development in Surrey, British Columbia, the courtyard between the four towers will be very much focused on growing food. And we're developing a food hall in the podium of those four towers where we hope to be able to actually deliver food from Southlands that's grown not too far from there and have this vertical integration of this whole concept that, you know, we need to be able to grow the kind of food that is healthy and is locally grown and like the next generation of farmers.
Bob Ransford from Century Group there, and my thanks to him for joining us on The Urbanist. Now, one form of urban agriculture that often goes over our heads is that of apiculture, otherwise known as beekeeping. You might be surprised to know how many hives already dot the rooftops above you, and that's certainly the case in our home base of London. To investigate this hive of activity, we sent our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, to visit a sustainable beekeeping practice in the UK capital. Let's have a listen.
In London's Aldgate East, imposing high-rise buildings overlook streets busy with traffic and commuters. On a sunny Friday mid-morning, there's a buzz in the air. These shiny skyscrapers are home not just to the people living in their glass-walled apartments. They are joined by some particularly busy neighbours. I'm here to meet Dale Gibson, the co-founder of Bermondsey Street Bees and the overseer of the rooftop beehives here. Today we're checking in on one of those hives, and I'll hear about what it means to be a sustainable beekeeper in the very centre of an urban metropolis. We pass through an austere lobby and head into the lift up to level 6 of one of the tower blocks. The hives are never placed above this point, as this is about the level of treetops. Anything higher would take the bees out of their natural airspace. We exit the lift and head outside to the terrace, donning white bee suits and picking up a smoker, a metal contraption that will emit smoke that helps calm the bees. There are 5 beehives here, each a home to up to 70,000 bees in all stages of development. We're taking a look inside hive number 4. I'll let Dale take it from here.
We've just said goodbye to one of the abseilers who goes down to clean windows and do maintenance, who says he always gets on fantastically well with the bees when he's up here and they never have any trouble. So we're glad that these bees, which we breed ourselves, are calm and amiable bees and get on well with human beings. After all, the bees have been here for 80 million years. We only really showed up a few 100,000 years ago. So I think it's great that we get on so well. Let's hope it stays like that.
At Bermondsey Street Bees, Dale works alongside his wife, Sarah Wyndham Lewis, who is a honey sommelier and writer. Since 2007, they have pioneered artisanal raw honey production and traditional ways of beekeeping in the city, always ensuring that the welfare of the bees and the surrounding natural environment is prioritised.
Well, we're working hard. It's not easy to keep bees in an urban environment. And let's not forget the bees themselves live in a very concentrated and very coherent social structure inside a hive. All the worker bees, which are female, are the queen's daughters, and they're all sisters or half-sisters to each other, which means that they have a very strong genetic relationship, but that's also followed through with a very strong social relationship. So for we in cities as human beings, there's probably a little bit we can learn from bees about living in close proximity to our neighbours and how we can behave really constructively socially to make everything in our little environment better. So let's open up this hive and just consider how these bees live in the city.
A smaller box at the top of the pile is where the bees will store honey. It's called a super. Dale carefully lifts it off.
You know, when we do this, we're going to enter a slightly different world. So their world is dark. Our world out here is bright. We communicate through sound and vision. So in the hive, the sound is buzz and the vision is dark. So they communicate through vibration and scent far more in the hive. So I'm switching on. I'm turning up my scent and vibration senses. I'm slightly lowering my visual and sound awarenesses because I'm entering their environment. So what happens when we take the top off is we change their environment from dark to light. So here are the bees making, in this case quite slowly, as you can see around the edges, honey. In fact, what we did is we swapped these less full frames into the middle of the hive, and we put the fuller frames at the outside of the hive, because the middle is where the heat in the brood nest comes through to the supers and where the bees find it more congenial to draw wax or store food. So here we've got about 50% complete super. Here's the queen, a little bit of a blue dot on her. So people often say the queen bee isn't as big as I thought she'd be, and they often say that when they meet our very own Queen Elizabeth II. But it's not important the size. Important is how you do your job, and I think most people agree they both do a fantastic job. So we'll wait for the bees to seal this honey and see whether there's a sufficient honey store in the whole hive to be able to take any of this as a harvest. There are years where we have zero harvests available for us, and here at Goodman's Fields that has happened once, and they were said, well, if that's what we need to be sustainable, then we're delighted that we're not getting any honey. If you came to us and said, well, we stole this honey from the bees and we're going to supply them with sugar, we'd be horrified. So the right way round of thinking about this is that it is not a honey game. This is a biodiversity statement. It's not a vanity project to have prize jars of honey to give away to people. It's purely to enhance the existing biodiversity features of the estate that's been built in. So let's take the super off. So as you can see, the bees are very calm. They're enjoying a nice sunny day just as much as we are.
The honey that Dale's bees produce, in the years when they feel able to take some, is single source, unlike much of the blended commercial honey found in supermarkets. Dale describes the bees as chemical factories, extricating anything contaminated out of the honey they produce. They are adapted to keep the good stuff and get rid of the bad, meaning that the honey produced in the very middle of a congested city is untouched by the pollution it is surrounded by. The quality of the honey has made Bermondsey Street Bees the recipient of multiple awards, and they keep some of London's best restaurants stocked with the sticky stuff.
I mean, honey is, after all, mankind's original luxury food. It was here when we could walk upright, and it was available to human beings at quite a high price in those days, because you'd have to suffer quite a lot of stings to feast on it. But honey is a very high energy food. It's also remarkable for its preservation qualities of itself, i.e. if you have honeycomb, it will last until you break the comb. And that can be an awfully long period of time. Yeah, I think that it wouldn't be unfair to say that city dwellers in general have lost the connection with the natural world around them. It's something which perhaps is more widely appreciated in the countryside. But because we live in an area of mass transportation, busy streets, fast food, and increasingly looking at new buildings without much space to enjoy greenery, that people have become more alienated from the wildlife that still exists all around them. I always like to remind people that bees live on every continent of this world apart from Antarctica. And even if you don't particularly want to come and see our bees, or if you don't like honey, you are nonetheless surrounded by bees, not just honeybees. There are a lot of honeybees around, but there are also 270 other species of bee in the UK.
Dale's declaration of his work as a biodiversity statement isn't just bluster. Bermondsey Street Bees is the only bee operation in London that is actually reducing their beehive count. They took out 30% of their beehives last year because they didn't believe they could be sustainable alongside the beehives that others are putting in. City beehives have become more popular recently, not only in London, but elsewhere in places like New York, Paris and Berlin. We've all heard the refrain that we should save the bees, but there are major issues with the solution to this being more and more beehives. Each beehive will bring in 50 kilograms of pollen per year. There's just not that quantity of untapped flora and fauna in London. Adding more bees without also giving them considerable amounts of their own food sources takes those food sources away from others. The level of planting currently taking place in the City of London just isn't keeping up with the number of new beehives popping up.
There are a lot of spaces that they've created which are inaccessible to their own residents. So these are undisturbed, large nest and rest vegetated spaces that have been curated by people like the London Wildlife Trust and, you know, are exceptional. You can't see them from the ground, but the fact is that they exist, and, you know, they're not up there selling cocktails in tents or having sort of crazy golf courses. This is purely for the benefit of London's wildlife. It's an unseen part of what happens in a residential construction, because it's often happening 3 or 4, 5 stories up. But it still is powerful when you see it, and when you're aware of the thought and the execution that's gone in to provide it, and that is essentially giving away space from their potential profit and making it into an expense and keeping it purely for the wildlife rather than residents or themselves.
We've come to another rooftop of a neighbouring apartment block. This one, too, is sleek and glass-walled. The lobby is empty apart from the gentle flow of delivery drivers bringing home workers their lunch. On top of the building are 2 meticulously laid gardens. One is accessible to the building's residents, but the other is just for the bees. And for a short while today, for us. In a city like London, where rooftop access is few and far between, this garden filled with flowers and wild grasses feels like an otherworldly oasis.
You know, I used to be a stockbroker. I used to arrive in the office at 7 o'clock in the morning and go home at 4:30. So I think that, you know, the change in the rhythm of life that you adopt when you manage livestock, and bees in particular, becomes the way in which your life is managed to a large extent by those creatures. Every day is different. As the year goes by, the bees' needs and activities change, and we adapt to fit our lives and schedules into their own direction and impulses. So that makes it challenging, it makes it varied, and it means that you're in touch with the seasons.
My thanks to Monocle's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs for that report. Rooftop beekeeping and city farming may seem a little inaccessible for the everyday citizen, but living in the city really shouldn't be an excuse for not trying to grow our own food. One studio trying to promote that idea is the Milan-based PewArc. Having worked on plenty of urban agriculture projects and even walking the walk with a rooftop garden of their own, PewArc have recently developed an urban gardening kit to attempt to cultivate a few more metropolitan green thumbs. Well, I'm joined now by Francesco Fressa, one of the founding partners at PewArc. Francesco, thank you for joining me. Can you tell us about your rooftop gardening system at the studio and how it's been made?
I must say it's not something that we started to developing just as a strategy. We were thinking about urban agriculture for a long time. But having a roof, a flat roof on our office, make us start to think that we should do something with it. And the idea was very simple, just make an edible garden. A garden, but not only a static garden, but an edible garden, which could be used by people in the office. So we grow, actually, during the seasons, tomato, potatoes, aubergines, and all kind of salads. So the garden is literally used from the people who are working in the office. We even use it for lunch. So it started to be from a system that we developed to enrich the roof of our garden to a social space where people are going and hang out and use as a possibility of having foods. And that's actually the idea of the agriculture, that we think on the other side as an architect is so important to bring back to the city.
But I guess the interesting bit is, you know, that we've seen many companies and many people think about this idea before, but you wanted to then take the nucleus of this idea to make something that could be shared. So how have you gone from having a nice food garden on your roof? What was the next step to make something that other people could use as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And starting from this philosophy approach, then we went to the next step, which is probably more in our blood of architects or designer, that we started to test the thing first on us. We said, okay, let's try to do a roof for us and verify how it works and what are the things that happening and how is the system that can be used to make this roof in a simple way. And then how to share that with other people, because the idea is that our roof is not an isolated thing in the center, but can be really relies on all the neighborhoods, on all the flat roofs that are available. So the idea was very simple. We took a pallet, a normal industrial pallet, that are also very cheap because you can take used pallets, and we use the pallet by the both direction. If you put it on the floor, let's say on the right side, you can walk on it. If you turn it upside down, you have a kind of a vase that you can fill with special earth, and you can grow the plants. So you have a grid of pallets that, according to the way that you lay it down, so it gives you also the possibility to be flexible on the space that you have.
If it's going to be a large-scale thing, it's easier to add it to a new building as you develop the building. But when you're retrofitting existing old Milanese buildings, when you go up to the roof, there may not be water services up there. You were explaining to me earlier, there's a question also about the amount of load that is allowed to be put onto a roof. Tell us some of the things which are complicated to think about when you decide, okay, I'd like to have this on my roof.
Yeah, well, of course, the structural problem might be an issue. So it might make the thing a little bit more complicated and sometimes expensive because the system is really inexpensive. So it depends on different situations. We had on our roof structural issues, and we propose to work with a grid of beams that normally are in steel, and then we propose a system of fiberglass beams. Basically, they look like steel beams, but are very light. You can cut it on sides. It's going in the idea of self-making things. We see it as a contribution first, and as a, I wouldn't say a provocation, but just a topics to start to discussing and to developing, and to understand that we have to do something for the sustainability of our cities, which is not only making beautiful but energy-saving buildings, to create in our cities urban spaces, gathering spaces, and introduce the green again, introduce the urban agriculture, because that's the story of our cities.
Perhaps lastly, the obvious question, the pandemic question, during this period here in Milan, in all our cities, but people were often locked down at home, looking at these empty balconies, wondering why they hadn't put plants on them before. Is there a renewed interest in growing things? Is there a renewed interest also for our mental health as well? Because we learned that actually looking after plants, growing plants, is actually very good for our souls.
Absolutely. Actually, during the pandemic, sitting home in the lockdown here in Milan, we developed, just as a proposal, a small element, a kind of a totem that is 3D printed with, of course, sustainable materials. And this totem, the idea of this totem is that you can have this furniture piece, which literally can put on a small balcony or even inside. And the idea is to have on this totem different functions that puts together working, free time, listening to music, and of course growing green. So the totem came in a way from our garden, from our strategy garden, to make it a small element that you can put in your apartment, especially in the lockdown periods that we hope won't happen anymore, but let's say quiet period at home, where you can grow small plants or small basilicum or other things on this totem, a little cherry tomato. You have a table, you have a place to charge your iPhone with a solar panel, you have a place to listen music. So this totem became a kind of a corner of your house that puts together all the things that we have been wondering, asking during the pandemic, how it will be the life in the future, the working in the future, the working at home in the future, just to have in difficult periods something that you can really also use with different functions for the work, for the free time, just sitting and enjoying music surrounded by some plants. It's helping.
Francesco Fressa there, founding partner at PewArk. Thank you for joining us from our pop-up studio here at Milan's Salone del Mobile. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Next week we'll be back in studio in London. But today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rabello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's the House Martins with Me and the Farmer. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.
Well, but if I'm late, he'll get me how. saw.